You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. We continue our conversations with local Chamber of Commerce executives. Today, I speak with Hopkinsville Christian County Chamber President and CEO Carter Hendricks about the retail advantages of being a border county and what new data from a Buxton Analytics survey reveals about growth opportunities, plus bracing for possible cuts to Fort Campbell if we go over the fiscal cliff. Carter, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, guys.
How do you market yourself when you're close to such a large metropolitan area?
Sure. Well, we recognize in our community that we are part of a regional economy that does include our friends in Clarksville, Montgomery County, as well as our friends in the southern Pennyroyal counties of Trigg and Todd County. And so we try to make sure that we market Christian County as a natural choice and destination for consumers from throughout the region, including those in Tennessee as well as those in our neighboring counties. And what we really try to embrace is that we have many of the conveniences and choices of a larger metropolitan area like Clarksville, and yet we have a little bit more ease of getting around and certainly lower taxation due to a lower sales tax in Kentucky versus Tennessee. So you try to take advantage of the strengths that you have and acknowledge that there are some opportunities for you to grow as well.
Do you see any benefits to that lower tax rate specifically during the holiday season?
We do, and where we really see the difference in sales taxes for the big ticket items, so appliances, TVs, cars, you know, things where that 3.75% sales tax difference between Tennessee and Kentucky really start to add up. And so that's where we notice it. Of course, in our groceries, we also see it pretty significantly, as there is no sales tax on groceries in the state of Kentucky, and there is the tax applied in Tennessee.
Are you somewhat, if all, concerned about the Blue Ribbon Tax Commission that's been working throughout Kentucky? They'll make recommendations to the governor, obviously, to the legislature, but what has been your input to that tax commission?
Absolutely. Well, we're very fortunate to have Lieutenant Governor Abramson here in September talking about some of the early ideas and concepts coming from the tax commission. So they gave us a pretty early sense on what was happening. We've encouraged our members to reach out and communicate through the process that was laid out to the public about their ideas and their thoughts. We surveyed our membership around some of the ideas we heard coming out of that September breakfast to kind of see where people stood on things like sales tax on services, sales tax on grocery items, giving local option sales tax to communities such as Hopkinsville, Mayfield, Murray, and so forth. And so we've got a pretty good handle on where our members, what they're looking at, what would concern them. And all we would really suggest is that no matter what level of tax, what form of tax the commission would recommend and the governor and legislature would consider, that they certainly consider its impact on businesses and don't do anything that would begin to jeopardize our small business community's ability to expand and grow as it comes out of this recession. So I think that's very, very vital, and we would certainly pay attention to what potential impact increasing our sales tax might have on border counties like ours.
How do you position the chamber and chamber businesses during the holidays to be more competitive?
Sure. Well, we're always encouraging our members to think about how they're marketing, what they're marketing, who they're marketing to. We encourage our members and our businesses to view themselves within the regional economy that they are part of. And so in that regard, to think about customer bases that extend beyond the city limits, beyond the county limits, and to reach out as far as they possibly can to secure their business model. For instance, here recently we just held an event with our partners in the TVA. We bought a new software program through a software group called Buxton's, and that allows us to understand how consumers behave, what they're interested in, how to market to them more effectively. We've shared that information with our members, and we'll continue to help them understand how they can be more effective in reaching their consumer by knowing who their consumers are, where they live, where they shop, what they're shopping for, how they're being marketed to, and we just think that's good information that will allow them to be more effective in getting their product or their service directly into the consumer's mind, and so they can become a choice for that consumer. So we're constantly looking at opportunities to help inform our members about that type of information, and then we also work with them and through a variety of sponsors to promote shopping local throughout the year. We've got a very robust campaign during the holiday season, but we work very hard in the non-holiday months to also remind folks of the importance of doing so.
You talked about the Buxton data. Was there anything that you found in those analytics that really surprised you about your community, something that you didn't expect?
You know, it's not so much that it was a shocking, surprising set of data, but one that's really interesting to me is through this software program, we're able to kind of backdoor how the consumer understands and gets their information. And so if you're a retailer or you're a restaurant or you're a service provider and you've got a very specific demographic that you need to market to, we can tell you through these consumer profiles, what are called mosaics, where these folks are living, what interests they have, and how to reach them. And it's that how to reach them part that gets me the most excited, because in today's hyper-competitive information flow, sometimes you're just guessing. It feels like you're just throwing a dart at the dartboard with a blindfold on, hoping that you're hitting with the right message at the right time to the right audience. Well, this begins to allow you to take some of that guesswork out of the equation. In terms of our shopper's propensity, there's interesting sets of data inside of that. It's so detailed. I mean, we can actually drill down to what type of furniture people are showing a propensity to buy, what type of bedroom suit or what type of TV brand or what type of dog food people are showing a propensity to buy. So all of that data is really, really intriguing, and there's certainly some of it that you just kind of go, well, I didn't know that. And then you hope that that information is meaningful to someone.
Let's talk about, too, what's on the horizon. Congress is still battling over the fiscal cliff, and if lawmakers don't reach an agreement, there could be some crippling cuts to the military. Now, many people still believe that there will be a deal struck, but there's still that risk of a significant cut to the military and bordering there with Fort Campbell. Is there any chatter going on there within the chamber or chamber members about bracing for something like this?
Yeah, we've actually been talking about what I think the policy wonks call sequestration, what everybody else calls the fiscal cliff, for quite some time here. We began really looking at this issue nearly a year ago. So we've been talking about it for quite some time, and actually when we went to Washington, D.C. back in October, met with all of our legislators and reminded them of our desire to see them come to an agreement before we get to that point. The challenging part is many of the departments and agencies that will be impacted have yet to receive strong instructions on how they're to proceed with the types of cuts they're going to implement. And so we can't know yet directly how that's going to impact if it were to come to fruition, but we do have a pretty good sense that it will certainly have an impact, that in particular at Fort Campbell we would expect to see the impact in contracts and services and construction, and it would be our estimation that Fort Campbell will do everything they can to protect their personnel size and to make sure that personnel pay is the first to be paid, not the last to be paid.
Well, let's get back to the holidays now, something a bit cheerier. Tell me a bit about the Festival of Trees there in Christian County.
Yeah, we're very excited about our third annual Festival of Trees, which will be held this year at the A.W. Watts Senior Center here on 7th Street in Hopkinsville. And it will be bigger and better than ever. We've got 50 trees or so that will be beautifully decorated by a variety of organizations and businesses throughout the community who have paid to sponsor those trees. Participants will be able to come in and have a chance to purchase raffle tickets to earn the right to win any one of the 50 trees that they may be interested in. And really the exciting thing about it, Chad, is some of these trees will have gift certificates and passes to Opry shows and football and basketball and baseball games. I mean, just a variety of things attached to them. Some of the trees will be valued at well over $1,000. And so for a dollar raffle ticket, you have a chance to win, you know, a valued tree of over $1,000 in many different instances. So just a wonderful opportunity to come out and get in the Christmas spirit, to have a chance to win a lot of fun prizes. We're going to have lots of entertainment throughout the Festival of Trees, which begins this Thursday, December the 6th, runs through Sunday, December the 9th, and starts back up again December the 14th through the 16th. And good live music, lots of fun things to do, crafts for kids, breakfast with Santa Claus.
And Carter, if you had one item to put at the top of your Christmas list for the Christian County Hopkinsville Chamber of Commerce, what would that be?
We would suggest that the best holiday gifts that we can give the community and that the community can receive is the continued creation of new jobs. We still have a persistently high unemployment rate in Christian County, and the only way we're going to be able to tackle that is to continue to create jobs and to make sure that we have the workforce ready to take them. So if anything I can ask Santa to bring, it's bring us a few more jobs and keep our workforce as skilled and trained, if not better than they are today, and we'll continue to see bright times ahead of us here in Christian County.
Well, the Hopkinsville Christian County Chamber of Commerce CEO, Carter Hendricks, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, guys. Take care now.
You can hear this interview and others with area chamber executives at WKMS.org.
George Beard lives in rural Callaway County, and he is a master in the dying art of willow furniture. But with the help of his apprentice, Justin Roberts, he's trying to revive the craft. Whitney Jones talks with the two men about how they were introduced to willow furniture and what their master-apprentice relationship looks like.
a small workshop filled with tree limbs, Justin Roberts bends, hammers, and pieces together chairs made from willow wood. He's been fascinated with willow furniture since his childhood, but little did he know that George Beard, the man whose willow furniture shop he often passed, would one day be teaching him the trade.
I remember whenever I was a kid driving by 94 because I'm from Murray, and I would always see his stuff on the side of the road, and I never put two and two together until later on down in life.
Since then, Beard has moved his shop, and it took 2 years for Roberts as an adult to find the master craftsman. After 1 4-hour conversation and several months' time, Roberts decided to move into Beard's home with his wife and young daughter and learn the trade full-time as an apprentice.
They were skeptical at first, but once I got out here and started doing it, they've became quite some supporters. They're very, very, very happy.
But the apprentice relationship hasn't been helpful for just Roberts. 84-year-old Beard sits in a worn leather recliner in his living room recovering from quadruple bypass surgery. He's thankful to have the Roberts family around to help him with housework and cooking.
It helped me an awful lot. My wife passed away 3 years ago this past October, and it's been pretty tough here, but with their help, I've been making it fine, feeling good.
It's easy to see that the two men are more than just master and apprentice. Before going out to the workshop, Roberts checks with Beard to see if he needs anything. Beard says no, just that he needs to rest. Out in Beard's backyard workshop, Roberts is learning how to make willow furniture much the same way that his teacher did. They both admired the chairs as children, then as an adult sought out a friend to teach them how to build the pieces. For Roberts, his inspiration unknowingly was Beard's old shop that sat on Highway 94. But Beard's inspiration came walking up to his house. As a young boy during the Depression, Beard saw a group of gypsies carrying willow furniture on his street, which made him call out to his mother.
And they got furniture on their head. I can remember that just like it was yesterday.
When the gypsies passed his house the second time, they stopped, and Beard, along with his mother and father, looked at the furniture.
There was one small chair there, kid-sized chair. And I done fell in love with that because I said it. He brought it over to me because I guess he noticed me eyeballed it so much. He brought it over and I just popped my butt right down in it.
He couldn't help but tug on his mother's apron and beg her to purchase the piece. After some negotiating, Beard's father bought all the items the gypsies were carrying, including the child-sized chair, for only $15. Gypsies carrying willow furniture were actually quite normal during that era. Many people in Appalachia also passed these skills down through their families. Some, like Beard and Roberts, relied on friends to teach them their skills. Beard learned the basics in just a week after he finished serving in the military in 1960 from a friend in Arkansas.
He showed me how to cut it, where to look for it and all, and we got what we needed, went back, he finished it up. And I thought it was the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
There aren't many willow furniture makers, but Beard modestly credits himself with the craft's reemergence.
I think I more or less reintroduced it to the country. I always felt that way. Well, after maybe a couple years after I started building it, started popping up here and there on different places, magazines and whatever. Well, it wasn't long until I had people coming up here to was up here at this place in Rome.
One of his pieces has even made it to the Smithsonian. Museum curators came down in the late 1970s and picked out a chair from the items Beard had in his shop. Many might think the labor of making a chair would be the most toiling part of the job, but the toughest part is often finding the willow wood for the pieces. Robert says about half of his and Beard's time is spent finding the wood. They actually don't use wood from the most popular willow tree, the weeping willow. They instead harvest wood from plants that look more like shrubs. In the 11 months since he has been working with Beard, Roberts has found two farmers who will allow him to plant willow on their land. But until then, the two furniture makers have to search for material the old-fashioned way, by foraging.
We get a lot of it along the highways, out on the secondary roads where there's not a lot of traffic. You find a lot of times in ditches. And the highway department, they're generally happy for you to cut it off to save them trouble, you know. And then we get around farms, on farms.
Making willow furniture is a sustainable practice because the wood grows back quickly when it's cut. Robert says he could easily harvest twice in 1 year from the same spot. Before becoming Beard's apprentice, Roberts was a cook and was even accepted into the Culinary Arts Institute, where Iron Chefs train. He hopes to eventually blend his two career paths together and create a sustainable tourist spot where people could come and eat a meal he grew and cooked while sitting in a chair he made. Visitors might even be able to take home a little willow souvenir. But until those dreams come to fruition, Roberts will keep bending the pliable branches on his knee to make chairs just like Beard taught him.
You just take it on your knee and rub it back and forth.
For WKMS News, I'm Whitney Jones.
Get all the fibers in the wood loose.
Learn more about Beards and Roberts online at WKMS.org. Also, see some photos of their work.
When we come back, Kentucky Public Radio's Charles Compton offers us a look at the enduring holiday appeal of George Friedrich Handel's masterpiece oratorio, Messiah. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. Kentucky Crafted is a directory of visual and craft, architectural, performing, and teaching artists, all of them full-time Kentucky residents. Members of the juried program may also participate in Kentucky Crafted The Market, which is a three-day exhibition held in Lexington each spring. It's been named the number one fair and festival four times by American Style magazine and is a Southeast Tourism Society Top 20 event. The Commonwealth's Arts Council oversees Kentucky Crafted, and the Council's Communication Director, Emily Moses, joined Angela Hatton to talk about it.
How does one get to be called a Kentucky Crafted artist?
So artists apply to be in these programs. They also have to send in samples of their work. And then a panel of arts experts gathers and reviews all of the applications, all of the samples, and then chooses the artists that get to be in the program.
And what perks does it offer to an artist to be in the Kentucky Crafted program?
Well, there are several perks to being in the Kentucky Crafted program. First and foremost, Kentucky Crafted artists get to carry the Kentucky Crafted brand, which promotes artistic excellence and quality craftsmanship in the Commonwealth. The program is a marketing assistance program, so it helps artists develop professionally, provides training, various kinds of training to artists, from business skills, marketing skills, communication skills even, pricing, that's something else that they can get help with. We have co-op opportunities for other shows, which essentially makes some of the big shows more affordable to our artists. So I just talked with an artist the other day who said she had wanted to participate in the Buyer's Market of American Craft, which is a huge national show in Philadelphia, for years. And she was a new artist to the program, and she's finally getting the opportunity to do that because she can afford it, thanks to Kentucky Crafted. So there are lots of opportunities like that that artists can take advantage of.
And why is it important for artists to have help on that business end?
Well, you know, artists are by nature and definition creative people. Many of them, sometimes their only strength is in the creative process and producing their work, which can, as you can imagine, leave a gaping hole when it comes time to do something with that work, to get it out to the public. And we want to help our professional artists sell their work. We want them to be successful. A program like this definitely offers them the skills that they need to learn from beginning, you know, through whether they've been at it for years and they just need refresher or they need some pointers. It really is for all levels of business and marketing.
Well, let's talk about who some of these people are. Some of the Western Kentucky artists in the program are Paducah ceramic artist Char Downs and then Thumbstyle guitarist Eddie Pennington. Tell me more about how Western Kentucky is represented in Kentucky Crafted.
Well, there are some really, really great artists in Western Kentucky who are in the Kentucky Crafted program and have been in the Kentucky Crafted program for many years. Mm-hmm. Barbara Harrell, who is a Murray artist, she's been in the program for a number of years, and her work blends early 1900s fashion with art to create these beautiful hand-painted items, many made from wood. Another Murray artist who just came into the program is Eva King. And Eva creates cut paper portraits, which are focused a lot on rural life images, tobacco farming, gardening, everyday activities. They're very colorful, and they're really, you know, one of a kind works of art.
And, you know, I think there's a sense of pride about buying art or going to even to see a performance that's created by a fellow Kentuckian. But I'm kind of wondering, you know, outside of Kentucky, what kind of impact do you think this has for people who are maybe from Washington State? Have you seen any impact outside of Kentucky for Kentucky Crafted?
Absolutely. Well, one of the really great things is that Kentucky Crafted, the market, is a wholesale and retail show for Kentucky Crafted artists. So there are buyers who come in from all over the nation, and they purchase Kentucky Crafted items at wholesale, take them back to their retail locations, and sell them. All of those items carry the Kentucky Crafted brand. So, you know, there are Kentucky Crafted pieces being sold all over the United States.
I also noticed when I was doing some research into Kentucky Crafted that as part of the guidelines for the people who are accepted into it, one thing they must do is contact their local legislators and keep them informed about their work, which I thought was very interesting. Why does the Kentucky Arts Council feel that that's important enough to include as a guideline for Kentucky Crafted?
We want legislators to know when money is coming to artists or groups in their community, they can hear it from us, but it also means something extra special, we think, coming from their own constituents. It all gets packaged up in a nice annual report every year that's made available, you know, to the public and to legislators also. But it's really important for people to realize that artists are small businesses. They're bringing money into our state through generating income, tax revenue. They pay sales tax. It's not that they're just creating works of art. They're also generating money for the Commonwealth.
Well, Kentucky Arts Council Communications Director Emily Moses, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
When you talk about the greatest holiday hits of all time, Handel's Messiah has to be on the list. After 270 years, live performances are still easy to find. There have been at least two in the Four Rivers region in the last week alone. Kentucky Public Radio's Charles Compton brings us this look at the Messiah's persistent appeal.
Even in its simplest form, it takes a small village to stage Handel's Messiah. The masterwork by George Frederick Handel requires at least a few dozen singers plus musicians. Then there are the audiences, men in formal wear, women in evergreen reindeer sweaters, and little girls in red velvet dresses jam themselves into venues ranging from small churches to sold-out concert halls.
It is kind of a phenomenon. I think Handel would be stunned if he was alive today to see this because it had a relatively so-so beginning.
Richard Crosby is a music historian at Eastern Kentucky University.
For most people, it's just part of their holiday season. It's like turkey on Thanksgiving. It doesn't seem quite complete at Christmas without hearing the Messiah, or at least the Hallelujah Chorus.
Crosby believes they're often attracted by traditions that predate Benjamin Franklin's stove. Perhaps the best-known tradition comes during the Hallelujah Chorus, when the audience stands. According to myth, King George II was the first to rise. Some say it was out of reverence, but perhaps as he neared the end of the three-hour performance, University of Kentucky music professor Jefferson Johnson says His Majesty was simply tired of sitting.
Well, who knows? I mean, you know, the king stands, everyone else stands. Maybe the horse that he rode in on was, you know, maybe the saddle was a little rough on his derriere. Who knows what reason would be. To me, it doesn't really matter why it happened originally, but it was obviously a very good idea.
There's also a tradition of big brass. When Handel's masterwork premiered in Dublin, there were few trumpets. They were only added in large numbers after his death. Johnson, who directs the Lexington Singers, says also added was the really big chorus.
It's a piece that has always worked with smaller forces as well as with large forces. I mean, there are accounts in the later, you know, couple of dozen years after Handel's death, of hundreds of people performing, you know, in the chorus and orchestra of Messiah's.
First the British, then the Germans and Italians fell in love with the big sound. And when they migrated to America, Professor Crosby says America's blind belief that bigger is always better kicked in.
German immigrants to America had huge choral societies, like in Cincinnati, the May Festival Chorus. And so it became popular for groups like that to do things like that as well.
This choral arms race eventually reached a pinnacle with performances like those offered by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
And his name shall be called Wonderful.
Given all those singers and musicians, it's definitely a complex operation, not something Crosby would care to organize.
There's so much to juggle. You have soloists doing these things. You have choral numbers, and the choral numbers are quite difficult. Especially with that type of Baroque singing, getting folks to sing that correctly and make it intelligible. The larger a choir you have, the more difficult it is to make it a clean performance so that it doesn't just come out like mud. So they have to be very disciplined in order to do that.
Yet everybody tries to do it. I mean,
not always successfully.
While the sound expanded, the piece itself contracted. The original Messiah, which traces the story of Christ from the Old Testament prophets to his resurrection, measures over 3 hours. Today, Johnson says the average performance is only about an hour long.
I'm very fond of the Christmas portion, and I like, you know, the Hallelujah Chorus. What would it be without the Hallelujah Chorus? And I like to end performances with the even bigger chorus, Worthy is the Lamb, and the Amen that follows it. From a choral conductor's point of view, it's hard to beat Handel as a composer of choral music. He really knew how to write for choirs.
In recent decades, music historians have rediscovered the methods used by Handel in staging the very first Messiah. And increasingly, choral directors have applied those methods, taking the Messiah back to small choruses, accompanied only by the instruments available to Handel.
Okay, now we know through the study of music history and performance practice, we know how it was done in 1741. Now, with our resources we have in the 21st century, how do we choose to do Messiah? And so that now we see two types of performances that I think have integrity.
So, for example, Johnson's Lexington Singers will offer the big Messiah, while the Lexington Philharmonic will perform the piece as Handel heard it. The Messiah's music can test the best performers into rangers. It's an organizational nightmare for choral directors and conductors. Its audiences find themselves stuffed into overcrowded halls. Yet, despite its age and complexity, The Messiah also spawns a community dedicated to a pleasing and transcending act of creativity. During this darkest, coldest time of the year, such a community is probably what we need. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Charles Compton.
If you missed performances of Handel's Messiah that have been given around the region, Dr. John Dressler will feature selections of the oratorio on a classical encore Christmas on WKMS on December 23rd, 24th, and 26th. We'll leave you now with a modern-day version of an 18th century Christmas carol that references parts of the Messiah, Joy to the World, off of the album Bitter Honey by Eve Barzilay, who happens to be Jewish.
Joy to the world, the Savior reigns. Let men their songs employ, while fields and floods, rocks, hills and plains, repeat the sounding joy. The sounding joy.
150 years after an obscure Illinois general named U.S. Grant took Dover, Tennessee's Fort Donelson, the modern-day National Battlefield Park takes on new superintendent Brian McCutcheon. After the break, we'll meet him, then we'll head up to Golden Pond, to the Land Between the Lakes new planetarium. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
Let every heart prepare.
You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. In 1862, Fort Donelson in Dover, Tennessee, saw a rather abrupt series of changes in leadership, from Confederate General Lloyd Tillman to fellow rebel General John Floyd to Union General Ulysses S. Grant. 150 years later, there's been another, more peaceful change at the top. Brian McCutcheon became superintendent of the Fort Donelson National Battlefield Park this past October, and he joins us to talk about his new position and its significance both to him and the American Civil War. Superintendent McCutcheon, thanks for coming by.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
You've been at Fort Donelson for a couple of months now, thereabouts. How are things going, settling in?
It's been wonderful. It's been 6 or 7 weeks. The staff, the community, our partners have just been as welcoming as can be. A lot of adjustment, but very enjoyable.
Mm. Well, by way of adjustment, you're a native of St. Louis, and you got your start at Shiloh National Battlefield as an intern. But you said that Fort Donelson is a very special place for you. Could you tell us about that?
Well, oh boy, from graduate or grade school on down, on up, I should say, we would go to Land Between the Lakes, Kentucky Lake, and my parents were great at nurturing me in history and my sisters. And Fort Donelson was the first battlefield, perhaps the first national park, that I ever visited as a tiny, tiny child. Went back several times. And I through undergraduate and graduate, did some projects based on Fort Donelson. And you know, thankfully, it just led into a career.
Hmm. Well, speaking of career, what drew you to historical preservation as a profession?
Again, my family's great in nurturing me in history, and my big focus had been on how do we preserve the history, not just through stories and not just through words, but in a tangible manner. And Southeast Missouri State, where I knew my whole life I was going to go to college anyway, has one of the only undergraduate preservation programs, and the door opened from there. It was just a great opportunity, and it's a super program, and it opened the door to this internship at Shiloh, and again, it transitioned into something for over the past 20 years that I've been grateful for.
What was it like starting off at Shiloh?
It was awe. It was literally just a sense of awe, a battle that so many know of that I focused on as a child looking at, and then to be active in the preservation and the interpretation and the protection of. Was great. I was the youngest on staff by 11 years on permanent staff, and so everybody was set, and they did such a great professional job. And here I'm, this hyperactive, bouncy, right out of college kid that was coming up with all these ideas, and it formed a great team, and it was a great 7 years.
And where did your career take you after Shiloh?
After Shiloh in 1999, I was offered the lead ranger and historian position at the Arkansas Post National Memorial in the swamps of southeast Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very isolated. It's definitely one of the national parks you want to go to get to. And it's a last Revolutionary War battle of the American Revolution actually occurred right after the war ended. They didn't know it. And first Union victory of the Vicksburg Campaign. So I had the privilege of being with two different wars and documenting that there. Very, very wonderful site. I encourage everyone interested in the Delta to visit there.
And then it was off to Indiana.
No, off from there it was off to Omaha, Nebraska. I was offered a lead historian position, an architectural historian position as well, with our regional office over 13 states, and spent 6 years on wonderful projects, many Civil War related, battlefield related, veteran related, and traveling the country and giving consultation to different historic buildings and sites and properties, and it was great. And it was after 6 years, I expressed to our regional director I really desired to get back into a national park itself, and I was offered the superintendency of the Knife River Indian Villages National Historic Site in western North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
It is the national park of the Plains Indian Tribal Groups, and it is a remarkable 2,000 acres of archaeology and heritage.
Hmm.
And we stayed there for 3.5 years, and then in 2010. Ventured down to George Rogers Clark National Historical Park in Vincennes, Indiana, Revolutionary War Battle of 1779 and creation of the Northwest Territory.
Hmm. Well, there's some work going on. I'll turn our attention back to Fort Donelson.
Please.
There's some work going on at the Visitor Center at Fort Donelson now. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. The exhibits that are within the Visitor Center are the original late 1950s, early 1960s exhibits, and they've done quite well over almost 50 years. We received funding to modernize the museum itself, though,
mm-hmm.
as far as exhibits go. And in doing so, I think come this summer, we don't have the dates fully in place with the contractors and the designers, but one will walk into a very modern, I think a little bit more accurate as far as interpretation goes, and for the modern generation, a little better explanation of relevance. And from a visual standpoint, I think it'll be quite striking.
I think that sounds important because I'm not sure that a lot of people, understand the significance of the Donelson-Henry campaign of 1862. Could you give people a one-sentence description of that significance?
One sense of significance.
Or is that even possible?
I'll paraphrase in an earlier conversation you and I discussed it, but Jefferson Davis saw the falls of Fort Henry and Donelson as an immediate blow and referred to it as a double-barrel shotgun into the heart of the Confederacy.
Hmm.
I think the opening up of the Tennessee and Cumberland Rivers all the way through Tennessee, into Mississippi, into Alabama was a tremendous blow. In Union advancement and division of Confederate forces.
Hmm.
And Donelson was key.
Well, what is on your to-do list as we continue through the sesquicentennial, the Civil War? What's on your to-do list for Donelson in 2013?
Become more familiar with the park still. six weeks. There's been a lot I've learned, and I'm very appreciative, and a lot I still need to catch up to speed on. One area that I definitely want to focus on expanding progress in looking at Fort Hyman, which is here in this county, and looking at the resource itself, long-term preservation, interpretation, and ideally as a community effort, what we can do to work together to really make people aware of this vital, vital fortification and its impact on the significance that I just mentioned of Fort Henry.
Well, it can seem out of pocket since it's removed from the core Fort Donelson Park over here in Callaway County. And it can seem almost a little bit out of the way, but I've been there a few dozen times. It's certainly worth the trip, I'll say that much. In addition to things like that going on in the community, there is, of course, the Fort Donelson Civil War Roundtable in Dover. Mm-hmm. How involved is the park with that?
I think it's more of the roundtables involved with the park rather than the park involved with the roundtable, and it's I think it's a mutual benefit. We're also, I think, we have a close relationship with the Civil War Roundtable in Clarksville as well. Mm. But having such a quality roundtable as the one in Dover is just a great, great benefit. And I see the opportunity, if my gang isn't doing it already, inviting visitors that may be staying overnight to say, hey, come attend this meeting or take part in this event. Mm-hmm. There is definitely a passion in the Dover the Dover area, the Stewart County area, this area. And I think it shows through, and I think it radiates into the park as far as the pride and the quality of interpretation and the partnership and the friends events that occur.
Well, you talk about partnership. What kind of opportunities are there for people who may not be necessarily park employees, but volunteers that care very deeply about this? What kind of opportunities are there for them to come and do their part for the park?
I think there's a variety of opportunities. The National Park Service has Public Lands Day. There's Park Day you've expressed in April. And but otherwise, for groups, be they youth groups, be they community groups, if there's a specific project or a project of interest that they may be interested in, by all means, they can contact us and we can see what may be compatible.
Mm. I'm also hearing that this month is the final month for a couple of long, long time staff members at Fort Donelson.
It is. Two vital members. And I mean, everybody's vital, but these two in particular. Debbie Wood has been our administrative officer for the past 8 years. She's had 36 years, I believe, with the National Park Service or the federal government. She's retiring as our administrative officer. And it sounds like a bureaucratic position, but it is the one that pinches the pennies, follows the, you know, enforces the laws and so forth. And she's going to be greatly missed and hard shoes to fill. The other one, and no less important, is park historian Jimmy Jobe. More than 40 years with the National Park Service, the entire time at Fort Donelson. Mm-hmm. And those in the community, be it here in Murray or be it those anywhere in the Western Theater, really know of Jimmy Jobe, the quality and not just his accuracy, but his humbleness.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to be a major loss to our interpretive effort as well, but he's still going to be in the area, and I plan to kidnap him from time to time.
and particularly as you get to know the rest of the park.
Exactly.
Well, Brian McCutcheon is the new superintendent of the National Park Service's Fort Donelson National Battlefield. Sir, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. It's been wonderful. Thank you.
Think about the holidays, and sleigh bells, holly, and eggnog will likely come to mind. But what about laser light shows? Well, according to the Land Between the Lakes' new planetarium director, Ross Workman, these are all can't-miss holiday attractions. Workman is no stranger to the LBL or to stargazing. He started out working at the planetarium more than 15 years ago before he took his own portable planetarium on the road. After years of traveling and working as a carpenter, Workman has returned to the place he loves most. John Walker takes us behind the scenes with Workman and gives us an inside look at this year's new holiday shows.
The sun appears highest in the sky. It shines down on us most directly and warms us most efficiently. And we have the season we call summer.
When you walk into the planetarium, the first thing that is going to strike you is the size of the room. It is 40 foot in diameter, the dome as we call it, the tilted hypersphere. The room actually has a 19 degree tilt to it. There are 84 seats set up in a sort of a stadium style seating arrangement with the stage. And central to the planetarium is our new media globe made by Konica Minolta. And that is sitting right in front of our traditional Spitz 512 machine, which began its service in 1979 when the planetarium was built. And during the season of Memorial Day through the end of the year, we have our laser machine that we use to present laser programs. And we also have our bank of computers and control system back here for everything that you see. So it's a pretty neat place to come in. It's really fun to listen to folks when they step in here for the first time. They, you know, they gasp, you know, like, oh, wow.
And what can you tell us about this year's holiday programming? We have anything really special set up for the Christmas holidays?
Oh, yes, we do. We have new programs again. You know, with the all-dome projector came all new programs. Christmas, we have a new program we call Season of Light. It is a very traditional Christmas show that discusses the traditions of Christmas. Where did the Christmas tree come from? Why do we have Yule logs? Why is greenery such a big thing to decorate with? We look at a lot of our Christmas traditions, and then we go and look at the Star of Bethlehem. What could have it been? When was Jesus born? Was he born on December the 25th? Was he born some other time of the year? Why do we celebrate Christmas on December the 25th? A lot of things are presented in this wonderful program. And if you want to experience where we get some of our traditions from, this is the show to see. We also have a program that we call The Star of Bethlehem. This is a program that was put together by myself and my staff, Rob Milner and Bill Futrell. And this is a program that we present as interpreters. We've kind of modified our live program called Skies Above, and we've named it Star of Bethlehem. We look at what could have been the possible scenarios that could have created the Star of Bethlehem. Was it science? Was it divine? You know, that's the question that is asked, but in the end, you know, the visitor is left to decide. But we look at the possibilities, and then we look at what is in our current night sky, and then we look at what is going to be in the night sky on Christmas Eve when we step outside and look up. That is our program that we run every day at 2 o'clock. We also have Laser Holidays. This is back. It's a very popular program. It is presented with our laser machine. It is purely entertainment. It has a lot of the classic Christmas songs by Bing Crosby. There's White Christmas, a lot of the other songs that are presented during Christmas. It's a wonderful time of the year.
And what can you tell us about people's reactions to the Star of Bethlehem?
There are a lot of speculations as far as what was it. You know, was it a planet? Was it a comet? Was it a nova, a supernova, meteor? You know, we look at those things in all of the programs that we present, both Season of Light and Star of Bethlehem. Folks are coming out with a sense of, you know, we like how it is presented. We like how it is presented by looking at both the Christian side and the scientific side. Here in the planetarium, you know, we're not saying that it was a star or it was a planet. You know, we're just presenting the information as you know, just something that is out there. But people are really pleased with how it is being presented. They're really pleased with us looking at both sides, both from the Christian aspect and from the scientific aspect. We haven't had a whole lot of people just to come out and say, hey, what was it? You know, they understand that it's something that truly cannot be explained, but they like how it is presented.
And if I were to walk outside of my house on Christmas Eve this year, what might I see?
You would see a nearly full moon. You would see the planet Jupiter nearly overhead at 8 o'clock. You would see Orion the Hunter, a very beautiful sky if it is clear. And I know most people will step outside on Christmas Eve and look toward the east to see if they can indeed see some bright object shining off over in that area, maybe as a marker of what we celebrate and why we celebrate this time of the year. But you're going to see a very beautiful moon and a very beautiful planet.
And what kind of crowds have you seen in this Christmas season, or are you expecting in this Christmas season?
Actually, we're expecting good crowds, and so far it has been quite nice. The whole year has been really really well as far as visitation is concerned. Everyone's really excited about the technology that we have now in our. This is a state-of-the-art facility. Folks need to understand that they don't have to drive to St. Louis or even Nashville to experience the technology that is out there. Our planetarium is world class when you look at what we have and what we're able to present. You know, we're expecting even more people. I have received several telephone calls, people wanting to come, especially on the weekends. So we're expecting a good Christmas season.
And if you had to pick a favorite show, what would it be?
Season of Light.
And why is that?
I like the traditional program. I do. That show has just got a special feel to it for me. Again, we look at the Christian-based portion of the program. We look at the scientific portion. I really enjoy the way it is delivered. Noah Adams is the narrator, and he does a fantastic job. It's just a beautiful show. Just hands down.
John Walker spoke with LBL's new planetarium director, Ross Workman. You can find out more about their holiday shows by visiting us online at WKMS.org. You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Angela Hatton, Whitney Jones, Casey Northcutt, and John Walker. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Markgraf provides website assistance.
We welcome your questions or comments about the stories you've heard today. You can email them to msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu, post them to our Facebook page, or tweet them to @WKMS. You can find links to all three at WKMS.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Thanks for listening.